Do you wrestle with dreams? Do you contend with shadows? Do you move in a kind of sleep? Time has slipped away. Your life is stolen. You tarried with trifles, victim of your folly. Without change, something sleeps inside of us and seldom awakens. The sleeper must awaken.
Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Eric Cohn. I want to thank you for listening and ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate right now to the show notes for this episode, where you will find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else where you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find our show. I'm joined for this special bonus episode of Acton Unwind by Dan Huger, Acton's librarian and research associate, Dylan Pommen, executive editor of the Journal of Markets and Morality and a research fellow here at Acton, and Daniel Boss, creative production manager here at Acton. This week, on this special bonus episode, we'll be discussing Dune Part 2 and only that. So be forewarned of spoilers. Spoilers are the mind killer. But of course, this is a book that has been out since 1965, so I don't know how much we could possibly be spoiling at this point. But nonetheless, you have been warned. So we've all seen the movie. We've seen Dune and now Dune Part 2 and wanted to talk about it. I'm going to note that there is also – we have a review. We're recording this episode on Wednesday, March 6th. We have a review of Dune Part 2 that we published at Religion and Liberty Online today. So yesterday when you are listening to this, we will put that in the show notes for people to check out as well. I think real quick, I'm going to go around because as I noted before we started this conversation, I have never read the books. Dylan, have you?
I've read the first book.
Okay. Dan, you have?
I have read the first 3.5 books.
I've read the first, or all 6 of the Frank Herberts, and I've read the summaries of the Brian Herbert, book 7.
All right. So we have, I have not read any of the books. So we have some different perspectives to bring to bear on this. So I'm just going to throw this open to anybody who wants to jump in first on what did you think of Dune Part 2?
So I liked it. I have a few takes on why I think it's good. I thought it was better than the first one. The first one I liked as well, but I believe Dan Huger had mentioned when that came out that, you know, some of the characters were unfortunately flat. And I don't think this one suffered from that. I think, if anything, some of the characters are more fleshed out than even perhaps the book. The big one would be Zendaya's character, Chani. And I think this is like my number one thing I like about it. There's a lot of things I liked about the film. But I like that she basically becomes like the Han Solo character for this film, in that what makes the original Star Wars work, to me, this is my theory, and what separates the original Star Wars from other Star Wars, for the most part, and why I don't think they work, is that you have Han Solo saying, I don't believe in any of this nerdy crap, right? And he makes it okay for the person, in the case of Dune, the reluctant girlfriend who got dragged into the theater. Basically, you have the lead actress being that character, saying, what is with all this nerdy nonsense? I don't believe in any of it. And it gives you permission to keep watching, in a way. Whereas if everyone bought into it and believed it, then you have to buy into it too, or else you can't enjoy the story. Whereas Zendaya gives that watcher someone to relate to kind of go along with it. And then maybe they get won over by the end with the whole world and the story going on. So I won't get into more detail because I'm sure we will. But I loved that. The visuals were great. The action was great. And there were other elements as well. But I think that was an excellent choice by Villeneuve and, you know, the other writers of the film. And I really think it to me, like, makes this 2-hour-and-45-minute film watchable. That is, to me, the number one selling point.
I like to think of there as possibly three categories in which to talk about this. The first is just from a technical movie-making perspective, like how it was as a film that was put together by Denis Villeneuve, who probably is one of the top working directors right now, certainly within the sci-fi genre. You go back through, you know, his sequel to Blade Runner was incredible. I still maintain that Arrival is probably in my top five movies of all time. I think that's just an absolutely fantastic film. And I often throw it out as an example of he was telling a pro-life story in that, even if I don't know that he realizes he necessarily was, or that the person who I think wrote for The New Yorker, who wrote the short story it was based on, realized he was telling a pro-life story. But I like how that is, it is in there and you can find that in there and bring it out if you want to, but you can also just enjoy it for the story that's being told. So there's the technical filmmaking part. There's the story of Dune Part 2, and then this is where you all will have to, you know, help me out, which is the how does it compare or contrast with the original novel? From a technical movie-making standpoint, it is really just an amazing film. The visuals, I think Dan is going to dissent from some of my takes on this. Again, you know, I have seen the David Lynch Dune. You can enjoy it, and I'm glad that it exists as an artifact of its time. But I think one of the reasons that this has been such a challenge to make into a film is because the movie making technology and techniques have just not been there until now to do the kind of cool things, to show the landscapes in the way that Villeneuve does, to show the different worlds and paint them in the different ways that he does. I think you needed to get to a certain point in time with technology and movie making in order to do that, to do enough good service to it. And then there's, you know, again, the story, which we'll get more into, but I did find it for 2 hours and 45 minutes to be a very watchable film. But the weird thing about it is that it felt, and this is mentioned by Joseph Holmes in the review that we published at Religion and Liberty Online. I think he's right about this. It simultaneously feels a little long and padded and a little rushed at the same time. I will dig more into the story in a little bit here, but there's the turnaround of Paul Atreides' character to, like, you know, I don't want to become Space Hitler. I don't want to become Space Hitler. I don't want to become Space Hitler. Here, drink this blue juice. All right, I guess we're going Space Hitler. It was a little too blue juice ex machina to make that kind of a turn, and I don't. You know, again, it's really weird for a 2-hour-and-45-minute film that I didn't feel uncomfortable at any point in time while watching. It didn't really necessarily feel long, but it felt simultaneously like we weren't really getting there, and then we rushed getting there at the same time. So we can dive into the themes in a little bit, but those are my initial impressions of the film.
So there's an old Fremen proverb that did not make Villeneuve.
Of course, Dan starts with a Fremen proverb.
Which is that, you know, one should be prepared to appreciate what they meet. And I was prepared to appreciate what Villeneuve has done. What Villeneuve has done is internalize the lesson of Arrakis, which is the attitude of the knife, which is chopping off what's incomplete and saying, now that it's complete because it's ended here. This is a ruthlessly pared down Dune compared to the novel. It may have to be so. We can get into that. But there are some problems when you pare it down. The great thing is the realism is better. You have an audience surrogate that Dylan has explained to us very thoughtfully. You have a rare 21st century film that draws on source material from the 20th century that focuses extensively on ecology, that removes all of that. This is very interesting. But you also have a director who is very, very visual. And Eric has pointed this out brilliantly. Like Villeneuve's films, this no exception, are beautiful to watch. The problem is Brian Herbert is a very, very talky writer. You see this progression. Dune is probably the least talky.
Brian or Frank? You said Brian, but Frank. I imagine you mean Frank.
Frank
yes.
Herbert is a very, very talky. I've not read any of Brian's books, but Frank is very, very talky. Dune is talky. Dune Messiah is talkier. Children of the Dune is talkier yet until in God Emperor Dune, it's all talking. So this is a challenge for somebody who brings a skill set that is overwhelmingly visual to this. And he makes like it's a beautiful film. It's an engaging story. I walked out happy, but I view this as a film inspired by the Dune universe rather than Dune itself. And part of it, you see it in the dialogue. There are even moments where Herbert, you know, is great with turns of phrase. There are so many times when needless alterations are made to this dialogue in order to simplify it, in order to bring it into a more 21st century tone rather than, and it's not as if Herbert was writing in a 20th century register. He's writing in this weird Bible Quran mashup where and Shakespearean elements and all of these things. And that is part of what makes the universe strange and compelling is the language. And that is completely abandoned in the visuals I brought to the fore. Now, this is my second criticism. We had a wonderful director that made a wonderful Dune. And David Lynch's Dune. And David Lynch's visuals are also incredible. He brings to life a very Baroque sensibility that you get in the novels of the textures, of the sets. Villeneuve is very clean, very modernistic. It's beautiful, but it's less dirty and less immersive. And I think it works brilliantly with the ships, with the wide landscape shots. The interior shots I'm underwhelmed by, completely unmemorable. Now, a great deal of this film takes place outside and in space. So, like, there's a lot done right here. But I think even along the axis of that visual dimension, I think Lynch wins out.
I'm gonna make one note before I get Daniel in here that because I know you disagree with me on this as well, but from the technical movie making perspective, and again, I have an appreciation for Lynch's Dune, but the reason that like to me it just you can enjoy it as an artifact, but it feels so incredibly dated. The sandworms are never in Lynch's Dune are never going to do it for me the way. And this is, I think, key to my point about technology needing to advance to a certain level in order to not have that just feel incredibly hokey to me. And it feels very hokey. Like the extent to which I'm being asked to suspend my disbelief in Lynch's Dune is just at a much higher degree than it is in Villeneuve's Dune.
I don't see Dune as fundamentally a work of realism. And I understand why Villeneuve made his choices. If you want a giant worm that might appear in your backyard and might convince you that it's real, Villeneuve's sandworms will fit the bill. David Lynch's sandworms are Ray Harryhausen. Esque sandworms, but Ray Harryhausen-esque sandworms also can rise out of the sand and approach you and your mother as you're terrified in a cave and breathe the cinnamon-scented spice on you both and terrify you in a way that Villeneuve sandworms never could because they never rise out of the sand. They're always either half embedded or they are simply swallowing things up from beneath. Both of those things are very cool. This also makes the sandworm riding harder for us to visualize. Because these Villeneuve worms are so anchored in a sort of bizarre commitment to realism, you have the sand riders who are constantly obscured by the sand itself, and it looks less rad because of it. Everett McGill and Kyle MacLachlan riding on a sandworm looks way, way cooler, especially when Toto is laying down the triumphal audio track beneath it instead of a Hans Zimmer dirge.
I bless the sandstorms down in Arrakis, Daniel.
I went into this movie sort of predisposed to love it. Sicario by Villeneuve, 2015, is probably my favorite movie. And I loved part one. During the beginning of COVID, I was furloughed, and one of the first things I did was just crush through reading the Dune books. It was a great way to pass the time. And I loved those books so much and really enjoyed part one. Part two was an incredible experience, especially in IMAX, and then I saw it again in a sort of Dolby Atmos, that sort of thing. And I think it's just overwhelming. You get the scene on Giddy Prime, the fight with Fedorotha, is just incredible with those crowds, the infrared, just this visually overstimulating sequence. Later, there's an artillery attack on Siege Tabra, and you feel it. You feel it in your chest. The bass is just thumping as it's getting bombed. It's just a great experience in the theater, and it's such a bummer that so many people missed part one in the theater, because seeing it that way as well, I mean, the ships coming in that movie too, just really, really great. I loved it as an adaptation, even for all the things that changed, because you can tell that Denny knows and cares about the source material. He's made changes to it that still feel a piece of the world that he's drawing from. And I think that's really cool to see. I think a lot of times you'll see adaptations that don't do this well, that a director doesn't understand the source material they're drawing from. Another book that I really love is Annihilation, and which Alex Garland made into a film in 2018 with Natalie Portman and also Oscar Isaac. And for as good of a movie as that was, I believe Alex Garland at one point admitted that he only read that book one time. You know, it's a 200 page book, and you read it once. And it's very clear that he didn't understand the spirit of that book, and he made his own thing. And I think that's where I see Dune and Dune Part Two, and I'm really happy with the changes he made, and especially because it feels like he too is excited about making Part Three based on Dune Messiah.
I just make one point here that I like what Dan said about talking movies, because we do have a very good and interesting example very recently, and probably the film that is going to win the Best Picture Oscar, which I always like the description of as it is a 3-hour long film that is dudes talking in rooms and a 30-minute sequence of the Trinity test of the atomic bomb in Oppenheimer. So you can do dialogue-heavy films. I think the challenge for someone like Villeneuve is going to be, how do you balance showing the broad scape of this world that's otherworldly and having the same amount of dialogue without turning it into Jodorowsky's Dune and the thing lasting for like 24 hours. At some point you do need to make those changes. I do want to come back to the changes that one has to make in making an adaptation from a book to a film, because I can always remember, especially when I was younger, that in many cases I would, if a film had been based on a book, in a lot of cases I had not read the book. In a lot of cases, my mother had read the book. And I always remember her saying that, the way to do it is, just one, to kind of prepare yourself to not like the adaptation of the film if you really loved the book, because of the changes that are kind of necessitated by translating something into a different medium. But that if you see the film and read the book after, it helps to fill in some of the stuff that the film had to leave out. But if you've read the book in advance, you're probably going to be disappointed in certain ways, because the way that you're going to just imagine these worlds in your head are going to be different from the way that one specific director is going to imagine these worlds. Certainly, different from the way Denis Villeneuve would, and absolutely different from the way that David Lynch would, because I don't think anybody has ever imagined anything the same way that David Lynch has. So I think that'll be an interesting part to dive into.
So to build on what Daniel said, In comparison to the David Lynch version, in some ways, David Lynch is truer to the source material. And I think Dan Huger is right about that. But he does introduce some changes. And those are wildly at variance, in my opinion, with the spirit of the source. You know, Patrick Stewart is carrying a pug in the middle of a gunfight for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
They milk a cat at one point for no reason. They're just weird David Lynch things. Like, in some ways, David Lynch is perfect because he has this very strange mind. And, you know, like the weird dream sequence of the sleeper awakening, which doesn't even happen in Villeneuve's version. He does have a dream, but that phrase, the sleeper should awaken, does not occur. But, like, you know, Lynch does a great job with that kind of surreal dream sequence sort of stuff. So in some ways he was perfect for it, but in other ways he's just like throwing in random weird trippy stuff that he likes, and it doesn't feel in the spirit of the world.
The one I want to mention too, because it always sticks out to me, I think it's Sting that he asks, like, you know, prance around while you're having this conversation. Like, why was this director? There was a podcast from the Dispatch where Jonah Goldberg and David French were talking about Dune, and I love the point that one of them made, that, you know, the way that you make a movie, especially back then, is that at the end of the day you'd watch the dailies, and just the idea of like going in and watching some of the things that David Lynch had asked people to do and being like, yeah, that's it, we nailed it. It speaks to David Lynch's approach to all of this, but to a, you know, I like David Lynch's work, but it is, you know, famously weird and often inaccessible. You know, this is in a way probably one of the more accessible things, but you're absolutely right that there are just some very interesting choices that he made in making that film.
Those who don't know, they don't know. Those who know, they enjoy. One of the big departures.
We're going to have prophecy just from this podcast itself, and it is all going to be from the from Maud Dan here.
One of the things that Lynch does right that Villeneuve cuts out is give the background to the universe. Now, the Reverend Mother, Gaius Helen Moem, who is, of course, the Reverend Mother who gives the test to Paul in part one. She has a role to play in Villeneuve's part two. She describes it like this in the novel. She says that once men turned their thinking over to machines in the hope that this would set them free, but that only permitted other men with machines to enslave them. This causes a Butlerian jihad, is how this is referred to in the novels, and all computers are destroyed. This also explains part of the reason that human civilization is why how it's set up in the Dune universe. This explains why the Bene Gesserit are who they are and do what they do. They are the humans that plan the politics of this world. The Spacing Guild, the Guild Navigators, who are completely omitted from Villeneuve's Dune, are the ones that make space travel possible in a world in which there are no computers to make these calculations. There are also the Mentats, who get very short shrift in Villeneuve's Dune, who do the sort of planning. Tufer Hiawat, who I don't believe is in the second film at all.
No, he was cut out.
Okay. He was in the first film. He is the one that's in charge of security. But there's a reason that these people are involved. And Paul is related to all of them. Paul is trained by his father as a mentat, which is, again, not seen in Villeneuve's Dune. He is trained by his mother in the ways of the Bene Gesserit, is very much shown in Dune. And then his exposure to the spice gives him Spacing Guild-esque prescience on the universe. Lynch gives you all of those three in the first scene. Along with a very disturbing Spacing Guild member in a tank that will be seared in your memory till the end of time. So, like, while Villeneuve is, like, I can't help but feel that this is a weakness of the Villeneuve film, because again, Villeneuve has nearly 6 hours over which to develop this, and Lynch does it in a scene. And that feels like a failing to me.
So, I mean, I see where you're getting at. I've only read the book once, so I'm not like as big of a fan. But I guess when I go into a movie, I ask myself, especially when based on a book, like, can I just enjoy this as a movie? And then I expect there to be differences. Do those differences feel like betrayals? And to Daniel's point, I didn't really feel that way. I do agree with Dan that in some ways, I do think Villeneuve flattens out characters and part of the plot. And that I do think is a weakness. I don't know. I feel like Lynch is just, I love David Lynch. I especially love the, you know, Twin Peaks, the TV show. But I think there are definite merits for his Dune, but the pendulum swings way too far in the other direction to me. So, you know, he might have had a great scene, but there's a whole other 3 hours to that movie, and it doesn't always balance out. Another way to evaluate this movie is just to compare it to Part One. And in that sense, I kind of mentioned that at the beginning, I do think Villeneuve does a better job. So there are things like Huey, who is kind of like the Judas betrayer character, is supposed to be very conflicted. And he's doing what he does under duress. And you barely get, he's just this kind of one-sided villain that maybe has a slight change of heart at the end sort of thing. And you don't really get that story in a way that David Lynch did very well. And in the way that is really important in the book, he's one of the most interesting characters if you're going to split this into two halves in the first half. And in Villeneuve's Dune, he's not very interesting. So there are some real failings. Whereas, again, I think Chani is more interesting. There are things like Gurney comes back. He's now a smuggler because he can't do his actual job since the Atreides family has been, basically destroyed.
Bringing the other half of the Han Solo character to bear on this. Yeah,
yeah, but he also, Dan complained about the first movie that Gurney didn't sing at all. In the book, he's always like playing music and making up songs. It starts his first scene when he's reintroduced. He is playing his stringed instrument, it's basically a guitar, and making up a cynical song about the situation, the life on Dune as he knows it now. And so I feel like there was at least some positive adjustment on Villeneuve's part in terms of some real, correcting some real failings of the first part.
So, again, talking about this from the perspective of not having read the books, from the plot development perspective and the character development perspective, the things that didn't work for me are mostly related to Paul Atreides and Lady Jessica. That there's things that seem, again, as I said before, about it simultaneously feeling padded and rushed, as Mr. Holmes says in the review that we published, which, again, really resonated with me. On one hand, you have Lady Jessica in the first movie who wants to do everything she possibly can to protect Paul. And then in the second film, it's like, holy war? Holy war tonight? Can we do the holy war now? Do you want to do the holy war now? Is now too soon for the holy war? It just kind of is a radical change in this character that I don't see evolved on the screen into
that.
She
drank the water of life, man.
Well, I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. And then with Paul, it's basically the same thing, right? So it's like he has this clear reluctance to want to embrace this messianism because of what he can foresee and because is this knowledge that he keeps talking about that if he goes south on Arrakis, that it will result in the deaths of millions, if not billions of people. And then eventually ends up getting, I don't want to say coerced, but kind of, you know, compelled to have to do it anyway. And it all comes back to the blue juice that they milk out of the small sandworm worm that once people drink, it just apparently changes everything about them. I'm interested from any of your perspective of how that tracks with the book. I generally just do not like these kinds of, again, you know, Holmes calls it in the review a miracle plot device. It is just kind of a deus ex machina, right? It's just like you do this, you have this one thing and it changes everything about the character, and that's the way, you know, it's the cynical way of phrasing it is to reference one of my other top five movies of all time, Thank You for Smoking, where they're having this conversation between Aaron Eckhart's lobbyist and Rob Lowe playing this major Hollywood agent, and where they want to get cigarettes back into movies. And they're talking about having one that's going to be staged in space. And eventually Aaron Eckhart asks, like, well, but, you know, when they light up, won't they explode in a pure oxygen environment? And he's like, yeah. Rob Lowe's answer is like, yeah. Well, that's all right. We'll fix it with a line of dialogue. Thank God we invented the whatever device. And it is... Again, this is where any of you welcome to tell me if this tracks with the book well, but it seems just kind of like this very convenient thing to fix the problem of, as I said before, like, I don't want to be Space Hitler. Okay, fine, I'll be Space Hitler.
So I think it's not a deus ex machina. It's a Plato ex machina, and I think it works. Plato's allegory at the cave, the idea is that most people are seeing shadows on the wall, and they think that's all there is to reality. And some people think they're really smart because they get really good at identifying what animal shapes those shadows are. But imagine someone who breaks free from his chains, is able to go outside into the real world, see the real sun and see real animals. And then they come back into the cave and no one understands them. In fact, they persecute and kill them because they think they're crazy. It is the weight of knowledge. That is what changes them. And I think what happens with Lady Jessica, the pretty radical turn in her character, that she's almost kind of a villain figure in most of this film because she's urging Paul on to take on this kind of manufactured messiah role, which Paul is already fearful. He's getting these glimpses of the future. He's like, isn't this going to, you know, this is going to result in, yeah, billions of people across many planets dying because of me. But then he drinks the water of life and he says, I've saw all the possibilities now. And I know there's this just very narrow path that is less terrible than all the other terrible futures. And I think that's what, it, you know, maybe they could have dwelt on that more. With some more talking, perhaps, some more dialogue to really drive that home. But it was there. It was there, and it helped that I had read the book. So I can't, not being someone who's read it multiple times, it did help that I had read the book because I knew that was a major element of the story and of the character. And so the crumbs were there. If you had read the book, you would know, you know, you would probably be cued in a little more to what's going on. But I do think there was at least some kind of foreshadowing of what's to come just with the transformation of Jessica. She drinks this and suddenly she's like, we got to fulfill this prophecy. Like, I know it's, we made it up, you know, whatever. I mean, we'll get into that hopefully. But, you know, supposedly the Bene Gesserit are planning religious ideas all over the galaxy in order to kind of manufacture their power politics and things like that. And this is one of them, this kind of savior prophecy for the Fremen people. And Paul perfectly fulfills it. And it becomes very convenient that he perfectly fulfills it. And he's very afraid for half of the movie of fulfilling it because he doesn't buy into it. And then suddenly his mind is opened up. He has a far more, you know, a far higher volume of knowledge about what could come about in the future, and he sees no other way.
Dune is about space, time, and causality. One of the problems with Villeneuve's Dune, and one of the problems with making Chani the audience surrogate, is that you introduce the idea that there are Fremen that do not believe in the prophecy. This is foreign from the books. There are Fremen who doubt that Paul is the fulfillment of the prophecy, but there are no Fremen in the novels that doubt the legitimacy of the prophecy itself. What happens through the course of the narrative is, you know, Paul becomes the Kwisatz Haderach, the person who can be many places at once. He can transcend these limits of space, time, and causality that everyone else is bound to. The Spacing Guild a little less, but still bound in a way that Paul is not. So there is, you know, one of the memes that has come out of this is Stilgar, you know,
yeah,
saying, and this is sort of like a comic way in which it's treated.
You complete the Rubik's Cube, and it's like, Lisa Nagaiv. Yeah. I was going to come back.
It's written.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like, Stilgar is right. Like, Stilgar is right the whole time. Like, he is the Kwisatz Haderach. Like, this has happened. Now, the role of religion in Dune is complicated. What there is a very strong notion of karma and divine providence. There's not a real strong conception of a personal transcendent God. But, you know, there's, again, a line in the book is, you know, Paul realizes that there is no escape, that we pay for the violence of our ancestors, that this sort of jihad that he will unleash on the universe is inevitable. It is even inevitable if he chooses his own death. If he chooses his own death, then the Fremen themselves, without him, proceed to go through the universe in his name, doing terrible violence. So what Paul is trying to do is thread this very difficult path in which he minimizes that and takes responsibility for his role as the Kwisatz Haderach.
Going back to something you had mentioned about the spice and the blue juice ex machina, I think that the spice isn't necessarily explained as well as it could have been, but I think that's because there's more focus on the characters and the relationships. And I think that's especially important in this medium of storytelling. I mean, you do get a sense, and I don't know if you've picked up on this, Eric, but I can't believe this. I can't remember if this is when Jessica or when Paul takes the water, but there's this concept of other memory in Dune, taking on of the memories of generations past, especially with the Reverend Mothers. And you see just like these sort of side-lit women in these sort of vision that come about, giving a sense of that. And you get other senses when Paul starts eating spice. They mention that it's on the food right when he first comes to Siege Tavra. There's also bits when he starts dreaming later on with Chani, and you know, she's like, you've been taking the spice for quite a while. There's allusions to this, the power of spice, but it's never really spelled out. And I don't know if that's a problem or not, but I do think that, I mean, even the Guild Navigator stuff, I don't believe that they really ever talk about the fact that, yeah, spice is important for this massive interstellar travel.
Yeah, that's a good point. That I will confess that some of my understanding of all of that is having either listened to or watch other things that help to supplement my knowledge, which is the thing that I wonder about modern filmmaking, especially if you're going to do something like adapting a book like this or a series of books like this into a film, the understanding that it has never been easier to access more information, not just from reading the book, but from all kinds of other conversations, right? So there's a book that I reference fairly regularly, and it's a good one I recommend to people. It's by Chuck Klosterman called But What If We're Wrong? And the whole attempt of the book is to look at the future the way that we look at the past. And one of the points he makes in there is like, you know, what is going to be considered some of the great literature of our current time? And his answer is almost certainly nothing that we consider to be great literature of this current time right now, because everything possible that can be written or said about it, that can be asked of the author, that the author can say about it, is going to be recorded and is going to exist out there. The things that will likely be considered great literature are going to be the stuff decades, if not centuries from now, are looked back upon, and there's just not a whole lot of record on it. And people are able to read it and read into the things that they are interested in and the things that they like and draw messages out of it that they like without some kind of authoritative take from the author on, like, this is exactly what this means.
Just like Calvin and Hobbes.
Exactly.
Yes. Bill Watterson, famously reclusive, he doesn't give his opinion. He doesn't correct anyone's, you know, he doesn't license Calvin and his image, but people use it anyway, and he doesn't go after him in court, and it's kind of... No one will know if there was ever any dispute over, you know, he does have, like, there is a book, his 10th anniversary book, where he comments on specific strips about the background behind them. But beyond that, you're not getting anything out of him. And that's pretty rare in an artist today.
No, it is. And some of, like, you know, some of his anti-corporatism, I think, is that he has discussed, I think, is a little over the top, or in some cases more than a little over the top. But I like the concept of you birth this creation into the world. And after you do so, it becomes the property of the people who enjoy it. And they can kind of make of it what they want, and you can draw a different meaning from it. Not everybody has to take the exact same lesson away from it that other people do. And I that's one of the reasons that Calvin and Hobbes is enduring to me, is like, even having read that, you know, 10th anniversary and the background of some of the strips, it's like it still speaks to me in a very personal way that I don't know that I could share with anybody else.
All right. So to circle back a little bit and address some of the story elements, I think there is still a little more than Dan Huger is letting on, in particular with two characters that were fleshed out. Again, they're important characters, but they don't really play much of a role, although one of them plays a very interesting role in the book and in Lynch's Dune, and that is the Princess Aurelian, played by Florence Pugh, and the Emperor, played by Christopher Walken. Florence Pugh, the princess
of Dune.
The princess only appears at the very end of the book, but every single chapter begins with an excerpt of some text within the world. And a lot of those are texts of the princess's biography of Paul Maudib. And so you get her perspective all throughout the book, but in this weird kind of narrative way. Lynch just jumps on that and starts the movie with the princess narrating, and you have no idea who she is until the very end of the movie, and it's weird if you haven't read the book, whereas you don't even see the princess until this movie for Villeneuve, so the second half. But there is a conversation where, you know, it's the Emperor, maybe one of the other Bene Gesserit advisors, I can't remember, and Florence Pugh, I believe, is there, but they're talking about Paul, who they don't realize is Paul Atreides. So they're talking about Maudib, which is his Fremen name. And they're like, what do we do? You know, how do we suppress this? And says, well, if you kill him, they're just going to, you know, now he's a martyr, right? So it's not in the perspective of Paul seeing this future, but it's still commented on that, like, that is not an option. When people are motivated by religious zeal, you can't just kill their leader and expect that zeal to go away. If anything, it tends to multiply it. So there are things like that that it is maybe too subtle, but I do think that Villeneuve did successfully, if too subtly, include the breadcrumbs for some of that stuff. Like, I'm willing to give him that.
So there's an interesting thread about the way that Dylan brings out, there's one way that religion is handled. There's also an interesting way in which Stilgar is realized in this movie, which is as always the believer from the very beginning, which is also not how it happens in the book. This isn't to say, like, Stilgar, and this is very important to Paul's character, because as the book progresses, Stilgar begins to see Paul less and less as Paul, as Muad'Dib, and more as the Lisan al-Ghrib, which he refers to as a receptacle of awe and obedience in the novel. It was a lessening of the man, and Paul felt the ghost wind of jihad in it. So part of the problem is when you make these outside characters audience surrogates and you take the conflict outside of within Paul, you lose these other things. Why is Paul making this difficult choice? Why it is he is not he does not become Hitler because the blue juice told him so. Which, and you see this space Hitler meme arising from this film that you do not get from Lynch's adaptation or from a careful reading of the books. In fact, Herbert was very scandalized after the book that many people walked away from the book thinking that Paul was an uncomplicated hero. Not space Hitler, but space Eisenhower or space MacArthur. And I think that is a real, real shortcoming, is that because it doesn't grapple with the religious element as seriously as it should, because it doesn't grapple with this prescience, because it doesn't grapple with Paul trying to take responsibility for a world historic mission, but at the same time trying to retain aspects of his humanity and feeling pained at the loss of human relationships that comes as he assumes this responsibility, it makes Paul a less interesting character.
Well, I think too, Dan, you make a good point about removing that inner conflict that Paul has. I think a lot of that also is put on Jessica. You know, Jessica becomes this very sort of evil character pushing him towards jihad. At the end of the book, in fact, the very last page ends right after that knife fight, and Jessica is aligned with Chani's. Both of them in the book are considered concubines. They're Jessica, concubine to the Duke, Chani to Paul, and in that culture, that's a honored thing. And Jessica says to Chani something about how history won't remember the actual wives of the powerful men. They will remember both of them as sort of the queens and the ones that were behind these men in power. And it's a little bit disappointing that you do lose that internality, because it is an important part of the novel that it's hard to translate.
I want to read an excerpt here from Joseph Holmes' review that we published at Religion and Liberty Online and have you all react to it. And yet, it's the subversive themes of Dune Part 2 that stick with you after the credits roll. Because while the film ends with a victorious Paul Atreides, the film's protagonist, who avenges House Atreides against House Harkonnen, he is far from a heroic liberator as he morphs into a despot himself, waging a holy war against the rest of the Empire that will lead to tyranny and genocide, just as his dreams predict. Fans of the original Dune novels know that this was always Frank Herbert's intent, to warn against how easy it is to embrace the worship of a messianic political figure who becomes a worse tyrant than what you had before. This warning is timely insofar as the movie's release is concerned, as it seems as though more and more people in the real world are proudly abandoning a love of freedom to give more power to government leaders. A growing number of people are calling for and supporting restrictions on free speech, declining support for capitalism, supporting efforts to force parents to give their kids, quote, gender-affirming care, while presidents bypass Congress to do things like passing on the burden of student debt to those who did not incur it. Conservatives have often painted themselves as supporting smaller governments and more freedom, but the right, too, has begun supporting greater government power. See the rise of Christian nationalism, which includes a link to the piece Dylan Yu and Rachel Ferguson wrote at the Dispatch. The truth is, the reason defenders of freedom are losing the argument that freedom is better than tyranny is that we've forgotten a basic truth. It's not. Tyranny, in fact, is better than freedom if raw power to effect change is what you're aiming for. And the only way for defenders of freedom to preserve freedom and stave off a descent into totalitarian darkness is to remember that.
So this reminds me a bit of Anthony Bradley on Monday's podcast referenced David Koizis's Political Visions and Illusions. And he talked about how in the West, because we're so shaped by Christianity, when people abandon it, they're still looking for transcendence, still looking for a sacrificial messiah figure, and they're going to find it in all kinds of places. And it is one of the unique things about Christianity to say, yes, there is a savior, there is a messiah, and he already came. Right? We can identify him, and he is no human person alive today. I mean, he is alive, and, you know, I'm not, I don't want to get too theological, but, you know, we believe him to be the Son of God incarnate and, you know, risen from the dead and ascended and coming again. But there's no question of, like, could it be this guy? Could it be him? Could it be her? Right? And that's a really important check on the ability of governments to harness religious fervor in their favor. Now, it doesn't mean, you know, in the history of Christianity, there hasn't been some very bad pairings of church and state. I'm not at all saying that. But again, if you compare it to, say, paganism, you have the Roman emperors were often deified or considered to be deities after their death. And even while they were living, there was a cult of the emperor. This is where some of the first Christian martyrdoms come from. The end of the first century, is Christians refusing to offer sacrifices to the living emperor, who is claiming to be a divine figure of sorts. And I think in that sense, whether intentionally or not, which is somewhat fitting, perhaps, Herbert is kind of warning against that with the story of Dune and Paul Atreides. I do think Paul is conflicted, but I probably am, you know, to be fair, bringing some of that knowledge of the book into my viewing of the movie. So it might not be as obvious to people just going into the film, but I still saw him as pretty conflicted throughout the story. I guess maybe I'm not as able to separate all of the material in my head in every case, but you look at it and you have, I like the idea that the Bene Gesserit think that they are in control, and they have manufactured these religions and prophecies all over the galaxy in order to prevent, you know, basically another Skynet is kind of the idea. And they have certain things, you know, that they foresee coming about, and so they want to have a corrective to that prepared. They even have backup plans. So Fade Rautha, who is a literal sociopath and hardly preferable to Paul, weirdly, Paul could be worse and as far as what the future that may come. But they, you know, they're entertaining this idea of like, well, we'll kind of prop both of them up and see who wins between them. And we're just going to make sure that we have a way to control each of them. In fact, they like Fade because he responds to pleasure and fear, that he has these very clear levers by which they can control him, even though he's a literal murderous sociopath, right? And what's interesting is that there's kind of this cynical attitude towards faith and towards religion, especially towards common people's belief and faith, especially the people of Arrakis, the Fremen people. And yet, they do have these weird abilities. Like, they can control people with their special voice. They can, you know, they have a little bit of clairvoyance. Like, there's some weird kind of mystical magic actually going on in the world of Dune. That can't just be explained with like, oh, but really molecules or whatever, you know, like it's not
midichlorians. Yeah.
So then it, you know, there's a sense in which maybe they've kind of played themselves in that there's something true in religion. I think there is a true religion as well, being an Orthodox Christian. But as an Orthodox Christian, I agree with like Justin Martyr, who says, you know, there are seeds of the Logos all over in every culture and every religion, that there is truth there, and that one reading, I don't know if Herbert would even agree with this, but one reading is that they have, in trying to manufacture a religion and drawing from all these sources, they actually still have implanted something true, that you can't just dismiss Paul and his role and the Fremen's, you know, belief and zealotry as saying, but that was all manufactured. It's like, yeah, but it could also still be true. It doesn't settle that question in a very interesting way. And I think that's one of the, to me, being a religion nerd and a sci-fi nerd, that is one of the most compelling things about just the Dune world in every iteration.
I want to note that, again, the one here speaking from the perspective of not having read the books, I get the conflict. Like, it does come across to me. I guess I want to reflect more on the Plato ex machina, sure, of the point that you raised. You know, I I get where you're going with that. It's still just, again, came across as a very convenient way of solving that problem. But I think you make a good point in general. But I do want to be clear that, like, I do get the conflict. Like, it's not that it seems like he's willingly embracing the idea of becoming, you know, or becoming tyrannical, of the choices he makes leading to the deaths of billions of people, the resistance that he has throughout the entire almost two-thirds of part two to going south because of the consequences he knows will come if he does so. I think all of that did very effectively come across. So I just want to be clear about that.
Herbert himself says that when law and duty are one, united by religion, you never become fully conscious, fully aware of yourself. You are always a little less than an individual. And I think this gets back to what Eric is presenting here about this question of law and religion and duty. This is a live question. Now, Herbert also paints a positive vision of religion, which is not this conflation of law and duty, but is rather religion as a means of self-criticism, as a way of as a path forward for people who are not satisfied with themselves as they are, and they seek some sort of transcendent help to become better stewards of themselves and the world. And that vision is also does not come out in Villeneuve. There is not there is the danger of this law and duty becoming one in religion that is painted. But a positive vision of religion is absent in a way that is not in the source material.
Why don't we wrap it up here? Rather than going full Siskel and Ebert and asking you just thumbs up or thumbs down, because who likes a binary choice like that? We had enough of that yesterday with Super Tuesday kind of stuff, so we won't go full binary choice.
Oh, yeah, that happened.
Oh, yeah, that's a thing that happened, and we're not going to talk about it because what's the point? Let's do on a five stars. Five being ringing endorsement and zero stars being you apparently thought it was worse than the sum of all fears, the worst adaptation of a Tom Clancy novel that ever existed. So let's start with Daniel.
I'll go with my Letterboxd review, which is 4.5 stars with a like.
Dan Huger.
I'll also give it 4.5 stars with a like. I was very critical of some elements of this. This is a fantastically entertaining film that has great performances, great direction. It's absolutely wonderful. I would also recommend that if you can find it, there is a fan edit of David Lynch's Dune done by a gentleman by the name of Spice Driver that in my mind is a 5-star picture.
I give it like 4 stars. I think it was very good. It's hard with any adaptation. It's not so much that obviously I think I've been one of the more positive voices in this conversation, but there are themes that I wish came through a little more clearly, and you just can't include everything, but you could have chosen one over the other sort of thing. So, but I will say as an endorsement, I think if you haven't seen part one, you can go in cold to part two and you will be fine because there's enough backstory covered at the beginning that you'll miss a few things, but for the most part, you get it. You get every essential piece of information you need to be able to comprehend the story of Dune part two is in Dune part two. And that is also an achievement because if you're making a series of 2.5-hour movies or more than that, this is exactly the way you should make them so that people can jump in late and then, still enjoy it and perhaps go back and enjoy those previous ones. And I think he did a great job on that.
The worst version of the opposite of that to me is the Marvel films, which, it has just gotten to the point with them. So I've seen the first couple of Iron Man films and I understand enough of it from just, being online and having a pop culture reference set that, when I see memes of Thanos and things like that, I understand what it's about, even though I haven't seen any of those movies. And my big biggest problem is the amount of, so if, you know, if I want to see, what is the one with Thanos? I can't remember the,
Infinity War.
Infinity War or any of that. There's just too much homework that is necessary for a lot of the Marvel world to really get all of it and how it has come together, which on one hand is cool. Like if you are that, like that deep into a film series like that, to have that just expansive of a universe of it and the way that they all feed into each other is great. But the minute that you fall more than a couple films behind, it just becomes too daunting to catch up. And I just have not been able to motivate myself to do so or find the time to do so. So I appreciate the point that you're making, that I think you're right. I rewatched part one a couple days before I went to see part two. And I enjoy both of them. I would say I give it 4 stars as well. You know, I like it. I like it perhaps more from a technical filmmaking perspective than from the story. That's not to say I don't like the story. It does make me want to read the book, and it does so in, you know, it allow me to do what I talked about earlier on, which is that, you know, I can have that now fill in the things that you all have referenced from having a perspective of having read the book, that I will get backfilled rather than coming into it with a lot of ideas of maybe perhaps how I think it should be adapted to the screen, or be more noticing of things that I think are missing or would from reading the book. So it does incentivize me to want to read the book, which I guess is another good accomplishment of the film. Is it does make me want to visit the source material. Not everything that's been adapted from a book makes me want to visit the source material that it was adapted from.
I think that is actually probably the best endorsement I would give to any adaptation. If watching the film makes you want to read the book, even if they made some drastic changes, if you're like, wow, that was great, and now I really want to see where that came from, that to me is a successful adaptation. And I think this... by that metric is successful.
Okay, get yourself to God Emperor.
Let's call it a wrap there. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look in the show notes for a link where you can subscribe directly to Act and Unwind, or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find this program. Thanks to Dan, thanks to Dylan, thanks to Daniel. For the Acton Institute, I'm Eric Cohn. We'll see you next week.